All right, well, welcome everyone to the Iowa Healthcare Association monthly managed care member call. We're joined by representatives from Iowa Total Care. Today is December 9th, 2020. So I'm going to start this, how I do all my other ones, by going into some informational letters that have been published since our last call that would be of importance to you all. And I will throw these over on the screen here. These are the DHS published informational letters. Hopefully most of you are familiar with receiving these kind of updates, or you get them through our member bulletin weekly as they come out. But since our last call, there's been several notices published. I guess looking at them quickly here, nursing facility non-related party leasing arrangements. This is an informational letter that would be of importance to nursing homes who are in third-party leasing arrangements for their with their facilities. This really only impacts probably a couple dozen, maybe three dozen facilities in Iowa. But what this is doing, here, I'll just click on it. It's delaying the implementation of the rule for fiscal years ending in 2019. So this had gone into place, or was supposed to go into place for fiscal years ending 2019, but because of everything that's going on, they're bumping it back another year. HCBS incident reporting. This is another informational letter that you hopefully have seen in our bulletin, but this is for our waiver providers and making sure that everyone that, well, one, we know that we're supposed to be reporting incidents, but also explaining how to do so. And there's a webinar from DHS for you to be able to consume and look at and identify the entire reporting process and the timeframes for submitting those incident reports. So that is also out there, IL 2191. So make sure that you've checked out that. Grants for ICFID, SNF, NF, NIFME, and HEMIC providers. So this is in regards to the $14 million that had been allocated from the governor's office from CARES Act money that had been received by the state. These funds are supposed to be flowing to providers this week and is based off of total claims paid for room and board during state fiscal year 2020. So funds should be flowing this week. Make sure that you are attesting to those funds immediately or once you receive those, if you are deciding to keep those funds, because those need to be attested to by the end of the year. So you will be, if you have not, when you've received the funds, if you have not attested to them, you'll be receiving some kind of outreach from IME. Ensuring that you would like to keep those funds, because if you are not going to, they would be needed to be sent back to the department. So that is this informational letter, 2194. We do not know exactly when funds will be received, like what day specifically. We know that it's supposed to happen this week, and I have not heard from providers who have indicated to me that they have received those funds from the state at this point. And then the last one, this came out yesterday, it's a change. As you know, during the public health emergency, the MDS assessments, there'd been an ability for providers to submit those later than the scheduled dates that they're normally needing to go in, the scheduled due dates for those assessments. What the department is trying to do is they're trying to, you know, balance here, getting those assessments in, but still allowing some extended amount of time to be able to work on them, because what they're trying to do is get rates out timely, right? And we had some legislation that, or some changes in Iowa code, how we were going to be calculating rates, allowing for those to be calculated early so they can be transmitted to the MCOs ahead of time for implementation in their systems prior to claims needing to be paid. And so neither party needs to be working through corrected claims, right? with the delay in these assessments, it has created, I don't want to use the word backlog, but a delay in being able to calculate the case mix rates for nursing facility providers, which those rates come out quarterly, as you all know. And so what they're trying to do is balance the tightrope here by, you know, having them get in. They can come in a little late, but they still need to get in by a certain date so that way they can ensure that they're getting rate sheets calculated and submitted to the MCOs in time. So that came out yesterday. You will see that in our bulletin this week. So I would encourage you to look at that. It's 2196, explaining that process. And then I'm hoping you can see my screen. I don't know if that's the case or not, but
we can, Brandon.
Those dates that they're going to be using are included here as well. So that would be my quick summary. As I said, these are the informational letters. Hopefully you are utilizing these. I'll go back here. There's a place where you can sign up if you are not. So just under the information letter general tab, if you sign up here, you can receive those as they come out. So with that, I will pause and ask our representatives from Iowa Total Care if you guys have any updates that you'd like to speak with the group prior to going into the pre-submitted questions.
Brandon, thank you. As always, I appreciate the opportunity to speak to your association. And always keep us apprised of topics and issues that you would like us to speak to. So appreciate the heads up on that, sending those to us ahead of time so we can be prepared for you. The updates that I have is, as usual, please utilize our ITC website for provider configuration updates. Those are updated every Friday. We have our provider alerts and newsletters, and those are sign up for those if you haven't already. A little pop-up does come up on your screen when you go out to our website under the provider area, so please do that. Our provider relations map is kept up to date, so that information is out there as always. We have lots of folks going to be on PTO throughout the end of the year, as probably a lot of folks are going to be in your organizations as well. So if you are unsure who your rep is, or if you are unable to get a hold of them, we are suggesting that during the vacation or holiday time that you use our provider relations email box, and I am just putting that into the chat now. You can always use that particular box. In addition, if you, for some reason, are unable to get a hold of your representative, if they happen to be out of the office, and hopefully after COVID next year, our representatives will be out and about visiting you in the offices, you can, in addition to contacting them, if they happen to be out for any reason, you may also use the provider relations at iowatotalcare.com as well. Okay. So, Brandon, I'd like to pop to the question number 5 that you had submitted on prior auth, since we have Di here. If we could start with that question, that would be wonderful.
Sorry, I was trying to find my unmute button. yes. Absolutely. So thanks, Di, for joining us today. I know that you are the Director of Utilization Management for Iowa Total Care, if I'm remembering that correctly.
That's correct. Yes.
And so we did have a question submitted ahead of time from a member, but I know that I've heard this before from other members as well. And the question is, when Iowa Total Care sends a fax to a provider with a specific request of them, can the person making the request put some contact information for them to be able to reach back out to that person specifically? Oftentimes when, I think that what the play of events here is, we're submitting an off, Iowa Total Care is then requesting some additional information from us, and then we need to either collect that or identify where it is in our previously submitted information. So that way it can be inputted, I guess, into the system. Is there any, you have any comments on that, Di, as to, you know, if there could be a person who we could reach out to or how that should flow?
So I checked with my team. The faxes always have a return fax to send the information into, and it has their name. I've asked that they start including their extension, but that is kind of a slippery slope. And they told me that they don't always do it. If they have upcoming vacation or something, they don't want you to, you know, call their voicemail and then not get any further. So if you want the number of the person who sent it to you, that's great. But if you don't hear back from them, you know, if you call and leave a message and you haven't heard back from them within a day, I would say still call into the main number or fax it back. I just get nervous if you only are going to one person who might be out. Does that make sense? Especially kind of that same discussion. We've got people who will be off some across the holidays. So they can include their number. If you get back to them that day, yes, they'll totally be reachable. If you leave a voicemail and you haven't heard back in 24 hours, then you do need to use the main number or fax the info back.
Sorry, Di, I think I clicked mute on you instead of unmute on me, but that definitely makes sense. No, I definitely heard, we all heard everything that you said.
Good.
But I think that actually does make sense. Because we don't want to be waiting around for someone specifically. But I think oftentimes our providers are, when they're submitting an authorization, they will, I think, try their best to be able to get back with that person within the same day. And I do know there are instances where the information that may be being requested has already been included. So it's us pointing to where that may be in the packet of information that has been sent already. So it could be a quick conversation explaining where that could be included. So I appreciate the willingness of Iowa Total Care to be willing to put that information out there so we can ensure that everyone's, you know, moving as quickly as we can and being as efficient as we can. So
absolutely. Now, one kind of caveat to that. All of our cases pass through a non-clinical person and then a clinical person. So just so you are aware, if we only get a request sheet with nothing else, a non-clinical person will send out a quote generic fax that says, hey, make sure you send in clinical for this request. That person's not going to put their information on there because they're not asking for specific things. When a nurse does a request for information, it'll be, you know, I need the latest nursing note or something very specific about what's missing in the clinical. So I just want people to be aware it's possible they'll be asked for clinical by a non-clinical person, but that's only if there's nothing. But if the nurse who's requesting real specific things, those will have phone numbers.
Awesome. Thank you. And I know, mm-hmm. I mean, most of that is probably surrounding our, possibly our waiver and then our home health group, because our nursing home group doesn't necessarily have the authorization requirement for the long-term care population. But I know that we've had some conversations or some back and forth a little bit this week about home health prior authorization. And I know that on these calls, we've talked about the process before of how this should flow for home health agencies who are needing to secure an authorization, whether it's for a start of care or someone who's been on services for a longer period of time and you're just needing to recert them. Could you talk a little bit? I know we've done this before, so it's probably a repeat, but could you talk again a little bit about what that process should look like for everyone who's on the call? For a start of care, kind of what you're looking for, and then for a reset, again, what you're looking for.
Yeah. And just a second, I'm trying to pull up that document too. So for a start of care, one, a reminder that the first four visits do not require authorization, and that's to not delay the start of care and to also give you time to do your, evaluation, your assessment in form of plan of care. So the first four visits, you don't have to have an authorization from us to allow for that. Then for a start of care, we need to have the plan of care and the, oh, here, I finally got this to open. Just a second. If you stop sharing, I can pull this up, if that works. Oh, you know what? I think you have to enable participant sharing also, Brandon. Let me see. Yeah.
There you go. Now you can do it.
All right. There we go. Can everyone see my Word document?
We can.
Got some red print on it. Okay, yep. Perfect. This is what I was trying to get to open, and it was being uncooperative. So again, just going through, new home care member, no auth for the first four visits. If you want to have an auth on file for that, we would give it without clinical review. Then when we're going to do that first certification authorization, we need to have the assessment, the plan of care, which I know often the assessment is in the plan of care, but either way, we need to have both of those, and then a provider order. It can be a verbal order, it can be a note from the provider, or sometimes we get a discharge note from, you know, if they left in a facility, often it's inpatient facility, and there might be a discharge note or order that says they need home care. Any of those would be accepted for the provider order. And that's what we need to do the first review. We ask whenever possible to have your review periods line up with your have your authorization period line up with your cert period on like your 485. That just makes it more consistent for the documentation for us, because, you know, when the physician signs that, that's kind of their order. So that's a request, and I've seen some issues related to if you don't authorize to line up with your plan of care. That's why sometimes it'll look old, because your off period could be off by even a month. So then for recertification or renewals of it, again, this is saying please try to have those equal, be the same. If there's no changes in your request at all, so they're going to have the same level of service in this new cert period that they had in their previous one, we need a plan of care. It can be the new unsigned plan of care or the previous signed plan of care. Either's fine. Don't have to have both. Honestly, most of the time we're getting the previous plan of care, which is great. We understand that doing those new plan of care, getting them signed by the provider takes time. I'm going to go backwards. The plan of care for the first cert period doesn't have to be signed. We understand you might not get it signed. That's why we're asking for the provider order. Okay, so jumping back down. For the renewal, so we need the plan of care, new one unsigned, old one signed, and then we also need recent clinical documentation. Can be pretty much anything that just shows that the member's status continues to be the same. So it can be a provider note, it can be the most recent nurse visit or assessment, just something that has current information about the member. I know it's a snapshot in time, and that's okay. We just want something current to tie with the previous plan of care. If there is an increase request in your recertification, the first two points are the same, the plan of care, new one or unsigned or old one signed, recent documentation. And then we also need something that shows the provider is aware and wanting the increase in services. So a verbal order is allowed, provider progress note, but just something that not only says why there's an increase in services, but that the provider is aware of that need.
Thank you. That's awesome.
Are there any questions?
Well, I do have one, and it was one that was submitted ahead of time, so you maybe saw it, but it's number four from my list. And it's a situation where you have someone on services receiving care through Medicaid. They then have some skilled care, some Medicare episodes, and then they end up coming back to Medicaid. And
So when you say this, here's my question. Do you mean they go to a skilled, like a skilled facility and then return? Because I wasn't exactly sure what you meant by, or Medicare covers visits and then they come back to Medicaid.
Correct. I think that's the situation.
Okay. So here's my question, and we've kind of talked through this. In general, the plan of care is the plan of care. So if you're unsure when that's going to happen, you could submit it to us and we can have that authorization in place. So then when the Medicare ends, they just bounce to us. You don't have to worry about scrambling to get it in because, you know, you'll just have the plan of care kind of on file with us. So you can manage it that way. I don't know how much notice you have, I don't understand your workflow side of it. But the other option, if this is going to happen, if you send it to us, you know, it's almost like we would mentally want to give you those first four visits again. So like if within like 4 days to no more than a week and you write why you're sending it to us, then we can, you know, do that retro and add those visits in. I think the cleanest way though is to just keep sending your cert periods to us even as they bounce between us, because it doesn't hurt anything if you have the auth in place with us.
Okay. I'm going to ask Julie from our team to maybe chime in here. And does that make sense to you with how that should flow, Julie? If we have someone who's on service through Medicaid, they then have Medicare covering some of their care and then need to flip back. The initial question was, you know, when they flip back, we don't have those first four to be able to use again. And we're having a hard time getting in our 485 start of care and all that information done because we're getting a new auth. So does what Di explained as a process make sense to you? And if you're talking, Julie, you're on mute.
I wasn't talking, no. I think the issue is that they have to discharge them, and so they're starting with a new auth. And it depends how the agencies, when they're coming back off Medicare, they can either just flip the payer, or a lot of people like a clean chart, so they would do a discharge and readmit back to Medicaid. So there's going to be overlapping. They may not have completed one full auth, but the skill has ended and they're readmitting back. So the dates are going to get tricky is the problem with that. It's going to look like they had an auth already in place for certain days.
So
flipped a payer.
So we might have to work together because you're saying basically you would need us to end that previous auth perhaps early and start a new cert period.
Yep, that's what they're doing if they're having to discharge. So there's been some type of episode where they've relapsed or something new has happened and now they are homebound with the skill, and so they're flipping them to Medicare. So they're going to end that Medicaid off. They're going to readmit, sign new paperwork. And then when that ends, they're going to just, some will discharge from Medicare and flip over, some will just flip the payer. Depends how their agencies are laid out with their policies.
So if there's an overlap, you know, I don't know how often this happens, but if we have an existing auth, say, you know, there was a 2 month auth and it's still there, that would cover you while we get this, you know, fixed. So as they come back to us, if you bill a visit and you have that old quote existing auth in place, the claim's still going to pay. The claim system doesn't really care if it's on the previous Medicaid quote admission or the new one. But then I think you'll just have to, if you don't know it's coming ahead of time, which do you usually, is that something you know is going to happen? You know when Medicare is about to run out so you can send it to us?
It just depends on how the client's doing, whether they need to extend under Medicare or they've met goals and they can discharge.
Okay, so if you think it's coming, you can let us know. Otherwise, as long as you let us know within the week of when that change happens, but you're right, you're going to have to indicate on your request form that they're recently discharged from Medicare. And so we understand, but you don't have to do the old plan of care for the Medicare one can still be considered an old plan of care for our request. So you don't necessarily have to do a whole new 485 to send us that request. Does that make sense?
I mean, it does. It just depends how these agencies are discharging and readmitting on how what their paperwork looks like for the new chart.
Okay. So I guess to know more about this, I'm going to need to see a couple examples so I can look at what's being sent in and how big the gap is. So if people have specific examples they could send to us through Brandon, that would be great. We can look at it and kind of decide next steps or maybe have a little more clarity around how we're going to handle those. I think the big key will be putting in, let's see. We have been using the current auth. If it's current, we need, I'm trying to read these comments. Then where's Albert? Yeah.
I know
so, Ronnie,
you're
correct. You can call in and discuss with us. I think that's really just a case where you're going to have communication. So if you have an existing auth, those visits will still pay. So if sometime in the middle of that cert period, they went to Medicare and came back to us, as long as the date span is still current and you have visits, they're still going to pay okay. And then you can just, you know, update the request when that visit, when that auth ends.
Auth is going to be different if they've admitted. So they're in a whole different auth cycle of dates is going to be your problem.
I do see a comment
right
in here, Julie,
yeah,
that the person says if they do need additional visits or additional units, they would just call in and talk with the nurse at ITC to request additional services.
Yeah. Back to the four visits that don't require an auth, which would be at a start of care. When they do fill out and get the auth after those visits, are you wanting to see those four visits that didn't require an auth on the 485, though? They need to be included when they do get the authorization. Those are not excluded. I just want to be
correct.
Sure people understand
please,
that.
Correct. Please include the entire plan of care that includes those first visits, and then we build it for all of them. Then we'll be sure they pay. And if we need to update dates on that Medicare situation, just call us and we can work together and I'll talk to my home care team.
Yeah, I just want to be sure that that was said out loud. We may have some new folks on that may not have heard that in the past just because they don't require an auth, but they do need to hit the plan of care.
Brandon, as popular as Di is, she does have a hard stop 2 minutes ago, so I need to let Di go. And if we have any additional questions, please submit them in to Brandon, and we will get those to Di to help answer, okay?
Thank you, Di.
Okay.
I appreciate
Thanks.
You joining us.
Mm-hmm. Bye.
Awesome. Well, hopefully, I think that was very helpful. We'll make a request for that that document. I know I've seen it in like email versions, but haven't seen it in like a published ITC, you know, official kind of version yet. So maybe we can get that guidance out to members. I know, like I said, this isn't new, right? This has kind of been how we've been operating for some time now. But I think just as a reiteration, I suppose, for members to be able to make sure that we're doing everything right. And then if for some reason, when we are making our requests and we do have all that information included, we're then able to refer back to something that says, this is why we did it the way we did it. So. Jeannie, did anyone else on your team have any hard stops, or can we, should we start back at the beginning? I didn't know if.
I believe we're good to go from the top down.
Okay. Sounds good.
Thank you.
This one, the COVID relief rate process, and I know that the Iowa Total Care has recently published some Q&A, or a couple question and answers. Can you, again, talk about what Iowa Total Care wants the claims to look like for the COVID relief rate for nursing homes?
Yes, this is Hillary from Iowa Total Care. Can you hear me?
I can.
Okay, just making sure I'm in the office and on the office phone. So double checking. So for the COVID relief rates, I'll just start from the top of the Q&A form. So basically, the member is eligible while they're waiting their test results. If they turn out to be COVID positive, they are eligible for the relief rate from the time that they get tested until they no longer have COVID. So that was the first answer. And then as far as the billing goes, since this is retroactive, there's a possibility of having to submit corrected claims to go back and bill for those days that you would receive the relief payment. When you do this, because you have to have that DR condition code only on the days that the person is either presumptive COVID positive or COVID positive, you would have to bill one claim potentially for the days where they're just normal nursing facility days, and then a separate claim for the COVID days. When you submit the corrected claim, however, they do adjust the full amount of the original claim back out. If you submit the COVID days at the same time, you should receive payment for both of those back out at the same time, so you don't end up with any negative amounts on those claims. If there's new claims, you just submit the claims with the DR modifier separately from the non-COVID days. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so it would be possible on a new current resident that you could have three claims possibly in a month.
Correct.
In order to divide the DR code days.
Right.
Hillary.
Go ahead. Oh, I was just going to say, just because if the COVID days are in the middle of the month, you would have non-COVID days before and after those days with the DR condition code.
Perfect. One other question or clarifier, I guess I'd like to ask is, as we know, when we're testing residents for COVID-19, if they've had COVID-19, and I mean, chances are you're going to show up as a positive test result for a long period of time following when you're actually symptomatic or in some kind of isolation unit. My understanding was that after the person was no longer requiring isolation, that the COVID relief rate would no longer be applicable. Can you confirm, or maybe if I'm wrong, I guess you could tell me that too, I suppose.
No, that is correct. We kind of use the, as they're no longer testing positive, but I think if they don't require isolation, because there could be, you know, positives longer than they actually are able to spread the virus to other people. So I think isolation is probably a better way to look at it. So I agree with you. I think it's the amount of time that they are required to be isolated from others.
Okay. That was my read on the informational letter.
I guess
they had FAQs in there too, I know, for the COVID relief rate, and that was my read on that as well. So
Yeah, we can maybe change the wording on our end to make sure that that's clear.
Awesome. So the next one we have is this question. It says diagnosis code N183 is causing claims to be denied. I am definitely not clinical, so I do not know what N183 is. Do you have any indication of maybe why this would be causing claims to be denied? And I know this was, I think, submitted from a nursing facility.
Yes, so the diagnosis code is for chronic kidney disease, stage 3. And I was trying to go through the claims earlier and I was not seeing a specific denial reason. So I was having issues isolating what the cause of it might be. So I was wondering if we could collect some examples that you're seeing for the denials so that we can look into it a little bit further. There's denials for different things that I'm seeing, but I can't isolate one particular thing that is happening.
Okay.
So.
No, that makes sense. And Joe, if you're on, send me an example of that. And we can, and anyone else, I guess, who is maybe experiencing that. I know that, I don't know how common that is. I mean, it sounds like kidney disease stage three could be pretty specific where the number of individuals may not be very high. But yeah.
Hey, Brandon, it looks like that's an invalid code as of 10-1 when the codes were updated.
Yeah, I was just seeing that in the chat. So if it was after 10-1, they would have pulled that out of our system on the medical side. And so that could be causing denials on the claim side. But I think we still need examples to make sure that it wasn't happening prior to that. And if it was, send those examples over to us and we can take a look.
Okay. So I don't know if the person who submitted that question is on, but it sounds like there's some additional feedback. So I appreciate everyone's comments in the chat with that.
Yes. Thank you.
Next question we have is, I know a provider has been having claims corrected. They had claims corrected in June for a period from July through December 2019, and they're being adjusted again. Any comments, or Hillary, do you know if that's something that you've been tracking or hearing about, I suppose?
So I know that we were looking into client participation, and as I think some of you know, the rates for, or the client participation rates come through each month in an audit file, and they do change sometimes, so there is some adjustments for that. I don't think there was any project for more adjustments on those claims dating back to that date. So the only thing I can think of is that they were pending from a project and just now got processed manually. But if you have examples, definitely send those over.
And then we do have one other question that was submitted ahead of time. I'm not sure if Justin is on, and I know that there are some questions in the chat that may come back to you, Hillary, but just to continue to get through our pre-submitted, it's on EBV, so I don't know if Justin is available or on the call yet.
Yep.
Awesome.
I'm here.
Thanks, Justin.
Yep. Sure. And I think I just want to give a little background for this question before I answer the question, some of it you may find interesting or not. So how CareBridge gets their information. So we prepare three files that we send over to CareBridge. One is a provider file that just basically has the provider information for all the potential providers. And then we build an authorization file. And that authorization file is based off of those service codes that we're using for EVV. And then based off of that authorization file, we build our member file. So for all those members who have those service codes, basically the CDAC and Homemaker, we put a member file together, which would have demographics and other information. And the authorization file would have not only the authorization, but then the rate with it too. And so the authorization and the member files go over to CareBridge every night. So that's a daily thing. So you can kind of keep that in mind as I answer the rest of the question. But as far as getting, on your end, being able to see the authorization and then being able to schedule your visits, the first part of that is still going to be the case manager and the team's meeting. So they will meet like normal, have the service plan meeting. That part's normal. Talk about what services are needed. That's normal. Goes through the UM process. That's normal. And then once utilization management puts that, is able to go in and put that in the system and the authorization is approved, then usually it's the next day that authorization would show them in CareBridge. So it part of that, it's kind of a tricky question because it depends if it's somebody that's already had their service plan from that time until they show up, really kind of depends on where our UMQ is and what the turnaround time for our UM department is. But once it's in, once you are able to see the authorization in the portal, you should be able to see it in the CareBridge portal shortly after.
All right. Well, thanks for that, Justin. And I guess just for reference, the question was, what is the expected turnaround time for the MCO to upload a client into the system for CareBridge? So that was the initial question before Justin's explanation of how that should flow for providers. So hopefully that helped. I do know EVV, it's obviously coming very soon. 22 days, I think, is when the deadline for EVV is for personal care services. And I guess as another piece of information for providers who are on the call, we had a conversation yesterday with some leadership at Iowa Medicaid Enterprise, and with this implementation of EVV, it was determined very late in the game for assisted living providers of personal care services that this was applicable to them, right? So they found out about 3 months ago that they were going to be subject to these requirements as well, where the EVV system in general has been around for at least 2, maybe 3 years and just been continuously getting bumped, right? So AL providers of personal care services found out 3 months ago that this applied to them. And in our conversations with the department yesterday, they've indicated to us that they will be delaying the implementation of this for assisted living providers until 7/1/21. The expectation is that we continue to work through this system and continue to try to get it implemented, but the enforcement action would not go in place for assisted living providers until 7/1/21. So I do know that there are continued discussions on just because of everything that's going on with COVID-19 and these added administrative services, I suppose, for providers. There's continued discussions about the system as a whole. But right now we do know that 7/1/21 AL implementation has been delayed until then. So, and I don't know if that's, hopefully that's not news to either of the MCO partners. I think that they've been involved in some of those discussions as well with the department during this time. So.
Hey, Brandon, it's Julie. One follow-up maybe for Justin. So if folks on the home health side who are currently working within the system before the edits are turned on 1/1 are having delays in getting their patients inputted so that they can get them scheduled and provide service, is there someone, are you the correct person, or is there a different route that they should reach out to if they're not seeing their patients in there in it 24 hours?
Yeah, so here's the easiest way for me to kind of break down who to go to if you have a question. And then this will kind of circle back into that. If it is something that would happen before one of these pre-billing checks, which would include authorizations, probably would also include if you're not seeing your member in the system as well, some of those things that a case manager would normally review or do or work with the provider on, you can still go to the case manager for those things. If it is a question about how do I use this, how do I, you know, check in and out for a visit, or how do I do this in the system, then CareBridge would be the one to discuss with. Unless you're using a third party EVV vendor, then you would continue to work with them. if it's something after that claim comes to us, Iowa Total Care, then again, that would be an R thing. And that would be probably a provider relations where they can look into that, you know, claims issue or whatever is going on there. So I would say if the member is not showing up, that would be a case manager question. And they know that if they're unsure of where to go to, that they can come to me and I can help kind of look in the system and see what's going on as well.
Awesome. Thanks, Justin, for the explanation. Julie, thanks for the clarifier there. Appreciate that. That's all that I have submitted ahead of time. We can run into the chat here. I know we've kind of been, I've tried to take a peek. I know we've kind of been looking at some of these as we've been going. So let me flip through quick. I see, I think we discussed most of the stuff from the UM side already at the beginning of this. And then I see several questions on that 183 N183 code. On the add-on payment, how many days can we bill for? I've heard 10 and I've heard 14. I think the informational letter states that you can bill for 10. And then if you have another positive test and the person is still, you know, requiring isolation, you would then be able to bill for another 10 or until that person no longer needs to be able to be receiving isolation, and they're, you know, no longer symptomatic. So I know it says positive test, right? But like I mentioned earlier, you will be positive for months after you actually are contagious from COVID-19. So I think the what we need to be following is whether or not they're needing isolation services, because that was another requirement of the COVID relief rate, is that this person is being isolated. So if that's still the case and they're isolated because they're exhibiting symptoms, then you'd be able to, if you have another positive, which you probably will, you will then be able to bill for another 10, is my understanding of that. And I don't know if Iowa Total Care has any thing they'd like to add.
That is how we've set it up in our system. I think we're doing a retro review because of the possibility of being able to add on more days. So you are allowed more than that 10 days as long as they still require isolation and have a positive test.
Awesome. There's another question on, for the COVID relief rate corrected claims, do we need to list the covered regular payment days with code 80 and the COVID days as code 81 for non-covered days, or how should they be listing their 80 and 81 days?
So they're referring to the non-covered days as in days where days in the month where it would be on the DR condition code days, or days where it would be covered by Medicare or some other payer?
I think typically it's used for another payer source is covering those days, or right, maybe they're on bed hold or something like that is usually when you would use 81.
Right.
Just not sure how Iowa Total Care wants that to look. I mean, they're not technically non-covered days. They're just days paid at above the contracted rate, I guess.
Yeah, I don't think I would use the 81 code because I'm worried that it'll get hung up for third-party liability issues, or it might deny incorrectly for those reasons if you use that 81 code. So I would not recommend using that 81 for the COVID days.
Perfect. And I see that Kim put in the chat basically exactly the same thing that I said. So I'm glad me and Kim are on the same page with that as well.
Yep.
When will we see the payment? When will we see payment for COVID relief rate claims? I guess, is there any added timeline since there's probably some kind of a, I don't know if there's a manual look when that DR code is on there?
So they are looking manually right now on the check run. I know that we had some go out and pay at the regular rate, and we are working on getting those reprocessed right now. And I believe by the end of December, you should receive those payments for that additional amount. But they are doing a real quick review to make sure that the system is applying that additional money correctly before they go out the door, just to make sure that going forward, we don't have to go back and reprocess those and that they're paying correctly the first time. So we are working on reprocessing though the ones that went out incorrectly. So we will be getting those, or you should start seeing those payments probably within the next week or so and before the end of the month.
And then I think I heard you say this, but those who submitted the claims as we are supposed to and that just got paid the normal room and board rate, those will be fixed. Is that what you had said?
Yeah. Okay. Yes. Yep. So you don't have to submit any additional corrections or anything on your side. We are going to pick those up and get those paid out with the additional amount.
Okay. Awesome. I see a question about the XB and providers still get, this is home health, providers still getting the L6 denials requesting an EOB from primary insurance. This must still be some kind of a work in progress. Any comments on that?
Yes, so we have a larger configuration fix that we have to do to get the XB in the correct position in our pre-adjudication system or before the claim actually goes through the claim process. So we are in the process of adding the home health codes to our exceptions list. So if Medicare does pay, it'll still take that out of the claim. But if Medicare is or you weren't required to submit it to Medicare, it will go ahead and bypass that TPL and you won't have those L6 denials. So we're in the process of fixing that and then we'll be able to reprocess the claims after that.
Awesome.
And it should be in the next week, I believe. So by next Friday, it should be in. So going forward, you shouldn't have issues and then we can start reprocessing those claims.
There's a request. Can the 7-day notification requirement be reviewed for patients admitted to a long-term care SNF facility? I don't know if that is you, Hillary, or if that may be Jeannie.
I think it is Jeannie. Or
can the 7-day notification, say that again, can the 7-day notification, I'm trying to go back. It keeps slipping up.
It's towards the end, but I think what it is Iowa Total Care had granted a period of time where prior auths for admission to a long-term care SNF were going to be just switched to some kind of a notification rather than requiring the auth. My understanding of this notification piece is this would be if you have somebody coming to your facility who is skilled, and Medicaid only, that would be the type of person that, how I understand this as working, right? Because if they're coming into the facility as ICF or just needing custodial care, there isn't an auth requirement right now. It's just notification. But what there is an auth for is if you have somebody coming in from a hospital skilled to you and they don't have Medicare, they just have Medicaid, you would need to get an authorization from Iowa Total Care for their skilled care, even though I understand that you're paid the same rate whether they're Medicaid skilled or whether they're Medicaid ICF, there would be an off normally needed for those skilled people. So I don't know if Jeannie, if you have anything you want to add to that.
I do not. I, you know, to be honest with you, Brandon, I'd have to get clarification from Di on that.
Okay. No, that makes sense. I think I'm pretty accurate with
sounds,
that comment.
Sounds right. Yeah.
But I guess whoever submitted that question, if you have any further clarification that you would like or need, send me an email and we can try to track down more guidance for you. This is a question I think for Hillary. Can you indicate if providers are submitting those COVID relief rate claims today? Is the system set up to pay those correct as of today with the per diem plus 300? Just prior claims providers submitted might have processed with incorrect rates. So I guess in place going forward, are they good to submit this way and they'll pay right? Or there still need to be some edits done?
No, we did get it up and working. It seems to be working so far. It's just those past claims that we're having issues. So it should be all set up and ready to go.
Okay. And will XB and Box ID still be required on home health claims once your edit is working?
So once we have the pre-adjudication edit in place, which is a larger system fix, so it's going to be a while before we have that in place, it will start requiring the XB and Box 80. We don't have a timeline yet for when they've scheduled to put that into the system, but once we do, we'll let you guys know, and then probably also send out a provider alert so that you're aware.
Awesome.
I think we also have to visit different options in the system of how they can set it up, whether it's going to require it for sure or only if the person has Medicare do you need to put it in the box. So we'll get you more updates as we know, but we have to work with our pre-adjudication team to figure out how we can set that up.
Okay. So we are – don't do anything yet, anything different yet, anybody.
Right. Right.
Let's wait until we completely understand what we're going to – any changes that's going to go into place. So do not implement anything yet, but it's good to know that we are working towards some kind of an automated process. So hopefully there's no manual and then denials for L6 or any other primary carrier going forward in the future.
Yeah, we will do a provider alert once we figure out the full scenario, and let you guys know what changes you'll need to make on your end, and you can give us feedback as well. So
that's exactly what I was just about to say is, you know, as you're having those discussions and determining, you know, what's the best route to go, we'd love to be involved early on to be able to maybe explain from an end user perspective of what that looks like. So,
yeah, and we can definitely do that. We'll probably have a meeting with that team between now and our next meeting, so I can bring some follow-up questions for you guys on the next meeting, and we appreciate your feedback, definitely.
Cool. And then the last question before I allow or thank Iowa Total Care is, for the COVID relief rate claims, does there need to be a different diagnosis code for COVID? You need to be using the COVID. They need to have a COVID diagnosis on their claim in order for those to go through, is my understanding. Hillary?
Yes. Yep, that is correct.
Perfect. Okay. And it may seem like it. This is a call not just for COVID. It is a call for all MCO questions going forward. So I did have that question sent to me privately. It would be for anything, not just COVID related. But thank you to our team from Iowa Total Care for joining us and answering questions. I think it was very helpful. Appreciated the screen sharing and you know, kind of showing providers what you have. And if you could maybe send me along that that document with the prior auth criteria for home health, that would be appreciated. So thank you all for joining us today, and have a good rest of your week and holidays if you guys are enjoying time off.
Thanks, Brandon. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye.
So